I can still, despite the fact that it's now well over 10 years, I can still remember the very first sermon I heard when I went to seminary. Our preaching professor and dean of students, Tom Ridenour, preached a sermon whose primary theme was all about us new students having our mental furniture rearranged. And it was a good sermon. And I'd like to credit the power of that one sermon with the reason as to why I remember it so clearly and vividly. It wasn't that, though. I ended up hearing it 3 times. Every year, we heard the same sermon. Dean Ridenour preached that sermon at the beginning of every year because it was important to tell new students and remind the returning students as well, be prepared. Things are going to happen. He was preparing all of us for the difficulties we would soon face when in the midst of our education, well, we would be challenged with new perspectives that pushed us or pulled us in new directions. You know, there are a lot of folks out there who think often that theological education is really nothing more than a hoop we have to jump through. Oh, you want to be a pastor? Fine, you got to go to seminary and get a degree. Just get through it. I mean, there were some out there. Southern Seminary was all based on a pass-fail system. You passed the course or you didn't. And so everybody reminded themselves when they were struggling, P is for pastor. But while a lot of folks think that, there are just as many others who think it's more about a formative process where we come out differently than we went in. Something happens to us. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that our mental furniture is rearranged. No matter what, everyone who enters into theological education, whether they want to be pastors or Christian ed directors or deaconesses or associates in ministry, come to a point where they stand on the edge of a theological cliff and are asked to step off. Not leap, mind you, just step off. While we wrap our brains and our hearts around things at the core of the faith. And you know what? Sooner or later, every one of us is someone there who resists. And I think it also, this isn't just about people who go to seminary. I think this is something that's common to all of us. Faced with some amazing claims of Christianity, we all come to those edges and go, whew, what do we do? But you know, sometimes the couch needs moved. We refuse. We want to jump on it and hold it in place. And the more we seek to keep it in place, the more everything else swirls around us. And when, sometimes if, we finally let the couch move, we find a treasure there. Loose change buried, fallen underneath that comfy old couch. We don't necessarily get rid of that couch. We just move it to a new place. It's understandable why sometimes that resistance is really revved up for folks. That comfy old couch has served them well. They like it where it is. If we move it, we risk looking like Dick Van Dyke in the opening sequence of the old Dick Van Dyke show, right? Move the footstool, walk in the door, boom! Right on your face. We don't want to lose the comfort of that old couch, and we don't want to look foolish when we trip over the new arrangement. Keep everything right where it is. But different perspectives can be helpful. Not looking at different perspectives just for the sake of being different, mind you. I mean, don't just be different because different, but to bring about fuller meaning. And find rewards, like that lost change, that helps us understand the gospel more clearly. Deeper understanding of who Jesus is and why he matters. Well, I think today is one of those mental furniture rearranging days, at least in some regard. Today is Christ the King Sunday. This is a day when, look at our hymns, they're triumphant sounding. Jesus shall reign, crown him with many crowns. Jesus is our King. Now, other readings that we get, they might make us uncomfortable. But when we hear about Jesus returning and separating sheep from goats, year A in the lectionary, it makes sense because Jesus the King is in charge, and we certainly want Jesus the King separating the sheep from the goats rather than some other king. Another year, we hear Jesus and Pilate debating. And there in the 18th chapter of John, it sounds better because there's no violence. I mean, we kind of know what's coming, but there it's just no scoffing, just good debate between two rival leaders in John 18. But today, the lesson that we get seems strange. It's Christ the King Sunday, and we are talking, hear the reading about Jesus hanging on a cross, being scoffed at. King of the Jews is thrown around not as a victorious claim, but a mockery. It's not necessarily the first image we want to throw into our heads when we think about Jesus as a king. I mean, after all, when it comes to the crucifixion, I would bet that our thoughts jump to Holy Week, where we hear the Passion story on Palm Sunday as well as on Good Friday. Kind of put it on both ends of the week there. We enter into the darkness of that week in the midst of the great 3 days, Maundy, Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday. And despite being called Good Friday, we trudge along, most often pondering on our sinful behavior that brought about the need for Jesus to die most gruesomely. Can we now, lifting Jesus' kingship up, see the cross not just as a means of execution and gruesome and bloody death, but as a kingly throne? Now, when we talk about Jesus' death on the cross, it's usually the place where we find that attention is centered on the atonement. The atonement, that is, how Christ's death reconciles, or literally makes us at one with God. Atonement, at one with, it's what it means literally. And there are plenty of theories of atonement, how Christ reconciles us to God. And the one that we as Western Christians are probably most used to hearing is one by Saint Anselm, Vicarious Satisfaction. If you've seen Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, it's all about vicarious satisfaction. So briefly, Anselm's theory went as follows. Christ died to pay a debt owed to the infinite God by finite humankind, because humans had been unfaithful. But because of humankind's finite and limited nature, they're unable to repay that debt. But Jesus could, as human, act for the human debtor, and as God, make the payment fill the infinite debt. Everything gets reduced to a simple transaction right there on the cross. There's only one weakness to that. There's no need for a resurrection. If Anselm's right, Jesus didn't necessarily need to rise again. That's just sort of icing on the cake. For Christ to be king, we do have to see the crucifixion and resurrection as a unity. Not two events, but one. In Holy Week, as we move through the week, we might see them separately, but I don't think we should. When we talk about the great 3 days, we talk about it as one liturgy spread over 3 days. It's one service. You're greeted on Thursday. When Thursday's over, there's no dismissal. Friday, we enter in silence. There's no greeting. We leave in silence. Finally, at the great vigil, everything culminates. We've moved through the whole procession of the Passion there. One event. There, in that cross tomb event, Jesus is lifted up precisely to be the fulfillment of promises. He's shown to be Messiah and King by the Father, lifted above and victorious over the rebellion foisted upon him. For Christ to be King, we have to have both resurrection and crucifixion together. One event. It's too bad they only kept us with that brief text in Luke today. The Lutheran theologian Robert Jensen wrote about a compact theory of the atonement that Luther develops. And he wrote, "Jesus died in order to transform his promises into a testament." That is, think about will and testament, right? "The distinguishing feature of a testament is that it has become irrevocable because the promise maker has died. What by Luther's exegesis came to word with the Jesus of history was the promise of forgiveness, in which all of God's promises were comprehended. What Jesus' death did was to remove the promise from possibility of retraction or qualification. And the risen Christ then executes this testament at the Eucharist throughout the life of the church, and that is our salvation." Jesus' death then becomes linked with the resurrection to lock in his kingship and give him a way to exercise his rule, to fulfill his promises. In Jesus' death and resurrection, he is king because God has anointed him for that task, made him to be the promise. Jesus himself becomes the promise. Jesus doesn't bear to us the promise. He is the promise. It's a promise that the second thief recognizes. "Do you not fear God?" he says to the other. Jesus is the rightful king who will rule and bring to reality all that God has promised. And now being raised, Jesus, as king, rules in this world with the gospel. It's not to say that we have to implement it. It's not something, it's not a program that we implement here in this world. Jesus rules regardless whether we do it or not. And this exercise of this power, this kingship, looks different from the worldly rule that Jesus encounters in the cross. Notice, around the cross, both the religious leaders and the government sought to suppress his claims. That's what the sign at the top of the cross tells us. The sign is a message from the powers of this world, from the Caesar, to any others who would claim royal titles. The thing with rulers is God tried to warn Israel when they were begging for a king to be like all the other nations around them, is that they inevitably want more and more control. And those powers then do it by lording it over the other people, pushing down and oppressing so that they can keep their position. Jesus moves in the exact opposite direction. He takes the violent reaction against the reality of his rule, suffers death, so that the promise of his kingship may irrevocably be made known. And then Jesus makes his rule known through the gospel. The promise he holds for a new reign, not of worldly power, but of forgiveness and mercy, where oppression of this world's power is overthrown. And God makes us subjects of that kingship. In Paul's letter, we hear about being transformed from the realm of darkness to Christ's kingship, to that kingdom. We are transferred into that kingship by virtue of our baptism. Faith is the union of the believer to Jesus so that we are one body in flesh, as Luther wrote in a sermon on John 6. As such, then, our union with this king who rules in a new and distinct way over the powers of this world, well, that means something for us. We understand now our presence in this world as a way of making Christ's rule known. This is our vocation. We are like the crowd standing at the foot of the cross, idly standing with the powers of this world, tacitly joining in with their scoffing. And when we are transferred to that kingdom, our vocation is to be present in the world in such a way that Christ's reign is made present. We become royal emissaries. Our lives engage the world, so we obey commandments of Christ and bear Christ's image to the world. When we are united with Christ, or transferred into Christ's kingdom, it's not just a mere spiritual status for us. We engage our bodies in our personal lives at home and in our public lives as we engage the world. We become Christ to our neighbor. We engage. And doing so means that Christ lives in and acts through us. And by doing so, we announce Christ's lordship over all the earth. Which means it has a real meaning for our meeting this afternoon. I've always said that our mission spending plan is a theological document. Where are our priorities? What are we doing? Do we see Christ's lordship being made known to all the world through what we decide to spend on? I think yes. We're not all wrapped up just in maintenance of our building, but it's important. We educate. We share faith. We tell the good news. We gather here, where Christ continues to reign at the altar. That document should proclaim Christ's lordship. Here it is. Our furniture is rearranged. Christ's death is crucial to his kingship. Christ's kingship is crucial to our vocation. Christ's death is victorious in a way that's foreign to us. It's because it's wrapped up in God the Father's work of reconciling us and all creation to him. We may at one and the same time see Jesus' death and feel badly for our sins that took him to that place, but also find the treasure under the couch, that his death was part of something larger. Something larger than we could have expected. Jesus' death is his coronation as king over all that exists, including our lives, so that we may bear him in our bodies to the world around us. Thanks be to God. Amen.